Okay.
Just keep going.
So now I go.
Yeah. Our next one is This Little Light of Mine.
Is what?
This Little Light of Mine.
Let everybody hear This Little Light of Mine?
Last one is 1070, Mother, I Feel You. Thank you.
Good morning. Welcome to the First Unitarian Church of Alton. My name is Dee Evans. We are a unique place. In the words of Reverend Charles Schreiner, every Unitarian Universalist has the right to develop a personal philosophy of life without being told what to believe. We can learn from all philosophies and religions, and also from science and the arts. We explore life issues in a caring community, united by shared values rather than shared theology or philosophy. We try to live a good life and leave the world a better place than we found it. I offer my welcome to you, and in particular to those who are first-time visitors. We welcome you and especially encourage you to join us after worship for coffee and conversation. Information about the church is available from the new members' desk during coffee hour and from any of the people who are gathered here. We invite you to fill out one of the visitor cards found in the back of the hymnals and place it in the offering plate or hand it to an usher, and we'll send you our church newsletter for the next 3 months to let you know about programs, activities, and everything going on in the church. We are glad you are here and hope to see you again on future Sundays. We welcome everyone into this home of comfort, spirit, justice, and hope. July begins our summer schedule. The services during the next 2 months are lay-led or guest speakers. Some are first-time speakers in our pulpit, so we request that you be gentle, please. Also, our nursery is available, but it's no longer professionally staffed. It's led by volunteers. If anyone is interested in volunteering, please speak to Casey Combs Luker after the service. She's in the nursery now, so please do so. She would love volunteers. I didn't see any announcements. Okay, no announcements. Where is our chalice light? Oh, okay. Life is a gift for which we are grateful. We gather in community to celebrate the glories and mysteries of this great gift. While Garrett Kinder lights our chalice.
And off she ran to Hindustan and was never seen again.
Nelly the elephant packed the trunk and said goodbye to the circus. Off she rode a chompity chomp, 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 chomp. Now Nelly the elephant packed the trunk and tumbled up to the jungle. Off she rode a chompity chomp, chomp, chomp.
Night by night, she danced to the circus band. When Nelly was leading the big parade, she looked so proud and grand. No more tricks for Nelly to perform. They taught her how to take a bow, and she took the crowd by storm.
Jump, jump, jump. Now Nelly the elephant packed a trunk and tumbled
That wonderful prelude was Nellie the Elephant. It's not done yet? Oh, there's more!
Nellie the Elephant popped the trunk and said goodbye to the circus. Off she ran with a chompity chomp, 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 chomp. Now Nellie the Elephant popped the trunk and chompled up the trunk. Oh, off she ran with a chompity chomp, chomp.
Okay, if we were not awake before, we are now. I really like that, so. Our call to worship today is a quote from Madeline Lingle. Is that
Lingle?
Lingle. Stories make us more alive, more human, more courageous, and more loving.
Do we have a comment? Do we have?
Do we have our covenant slide? Great. Please read along together our new covenant to strengthen and nurture our welcoming community with love, compassion, respect. We covenant together to honor and make our diversity, respect our volunteers, leaders and staff by supporting balance in their lives and in their personal and professional pursuits. Encourage each member to develop a personal spiritual practice that cultivates honesty and acceptance. Remembering our humanness, we acknowledge our imperfections and extend forgiveness to ourselves and others. Engage within our own and larger community with integrity by taking responsibility for our actions, facilitating right relationships, and living into the journey. Okay, Yumi?
Tell me a story. It's one of the first things we say to our parents that has nothing to do with a physiological need. Stories are all around us, from Bible stories to the hula, myths to urban legends. They've been used as cautionary tales and for recalling ancient heroic battles. Even our entertainment, pure fluff like Star Trek, has given us cell phones, automatic doors, and some medical equipment. There are even some scientists today trying desperately to figure out teleporters so that we can all live like the people in Isaac Asimov's Norby series. As Einstein put it, without imagination, nothing is possible. But even more than that, stories dive deep into our psyches, letting us push the boundaries of right and wrong without hurting anyone and in the comforts of our own living rooms. Frankenstein, Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, The Picture of Dorian Gray, Moby Dick, just to name a few. They let us question our idea of government, letting us admire the pitfalls without actually having to step into them. Animal Farm, 1984, A Brave New World, Utopia, also just to name a few. But stories affect us in a more visceral way. Stories can help people understand each other. A study cited in Science Magazine in its October 2013 issue determined that literary fiction uniquely engages the psychological process needed to gain access to characters' subjective experiences. In other words, if you read novels, you can probably read emotions. The New York Times article, Your Brain on Fiction by Annie Murphy Paul, and according to research in Spain, says that when we're told a story, things in our brains drastically change. Not only are the language processing parts in our brains made active, but
any other areas of our brains that would be used when experiencing the events of the stories are too. For example, words like lavender, cinnamon, and soap can activate parts of our brain that are devoted to smells. Also, according to The Science of Storytelling by Leo Wittrich, whenever we read a story, we want to relate it to one of our existing experiences. That's why metaphors work so well with us. Whilst we are busy searching for a similar experience in our brains, we activate a part called the insula, which is in the side of your brain, but a layer down. And it helps us relate to that same experience of pain, joy, disgust, etc. And
was brillig, and the slithy toves did gyre and gimble in the wabe. All mimsy were the borogoves, and the mome-raths outgrabe. Beware the jabberwock, my son, the jaws that bite, the claws that catch. Beware the jubjub bird, and shun the frumious bandersnatch. He took his vorpal sword in hand, long time the manxome foe he sought. So rested he by the tum-tum tree, and stood a while in thought. And as an oofish thought he stood, the jabberwock with eyes of flame came whiffling through the tulgey wood and burbled as it came. One, two, and through, the vorpal blade went snicker, snack. He left it dead, and with its head, he went galumphing back. And hast thou slain the jabberwock? Come to my arms, my beamish boy. Oh, frabjous day, calloo, callay, he chortled in his joy. 'Twas brillig, and the slithy toves did gyre and gimble in the wabe. All mimsy were the borogoves, and the mome-raths outgrabe.
A poem by Jill Silverstein called Peanut Butter Sandwich. I'll sing you a poem of a silly young king who played with the world at the end of a string, but he only loved one single thing, and that was just a peanut butter sandwich. His scepter and his royal gowns, his regal throne and golden crowns were brown and sticky from the mounds and drippings from the peanut butter sandwich. His subjects were all silly fools, for he had passed a royal rule that all that they could learn in school was how to make a peanut butter sandwich. He would not eat his sovereign's steak. He scorned his soup and kingly cake, and told his courtly cook to bake an extra sticky peanut butter sandwich. And then one day he took a bite and started chewing with delight, but found his mouth was stuck quite tight from that last bite of peanut butter sandwich. His brother pulled, his sister pried, the wizard pushed, his mother cried, "My boy's committed suicide from eating his last peanut butter sandwich." The dentist came and the royal doc, the royal plumber banged and knocked, but still those jaws stayed tightly locked. Oh, darn that sticky peanut butter sandwich. The carpenter, he tried with pliers. The telephone man tried with wires. The firemen, they tried with fire, but couldn't melt that peanut butter sandwich. With ropes and pulleys, drills and coil, with steam and lubricating oil, for 20 years of tears and toil, they fought that awful peanut butter sandwich. Then all his royal subjects came. They hooked his jaws with grappling chains and pulled both ways with might and main against that stubborn peanut butter sandwich. Each man and woman, girl and boy, put down their plows and pots and toys and pulled until, crack, oh joy. They broke right through that peanut butter sandwich. A puff of dust, a scratch, a squeak, the king's jaws opened with a creak, and then in voice so faint and weak, the first words that they heard him speak were, "How about a peanut butter sandwich?"
If anyone would care to share any joys or sorrows silently through our water ritual, please select a stone from the bowls underneath this bowl, the vestibule, or here by the door, and form a line counterclockwise in the aisles. Now, for those of you who are directionally impaired in buildings like I am, that means come up this aisle and go out back that one. Okay, please, if you'd like to come up.
Before we meditate today, let us contemplate. Who are you? Are you insulated, cut off like Granny? Inquisitive and wary like Little Red? The instigator like the wolf? Or are you reactionary like the woodsman? Today's meditation is a speaking one. I would like everyone to say a word they think is fun to say, or comforting in some way. Hunky dory.
Dance.
Hullabaloo. Now please take a minute of silence to pray or contemplate after your own fashion.
Please open your eyes and come back into the room for our offering. We receive your offerings gratefully, and we dedicate them to the work of the congregation. Together, we seek to serve with ever greater love.
Please join in reciting the offering blessing. To the work of the church, which is weaving a tapestry of love we call community, we dedicated ourselves, and these are offerings.
Today's reading is from The Marriage of Heaven and Hell, by William Blake. The ancient poets animated all sensible objects with gods or geniuses, calling them by names and adorning them with properties of woods, rivers, mountains, lakes, cities, nations, and whatever their enlarged and numerous senses could perceive. And particularly, they studied the genius of each city and country, placing it under its mental deity. Till a system was formed, which took some advantage of and enslaved the vulgar by attempting to realize or abstract the mental deities from their objects. Thus began the priesthood, choosing forms of worship from poetic tales. And at length, they pronounced that the gods had ordered such things. Thus men forgot that all deities reside in the human breast.
My name is Yomi. In Japanese, it literally means read. Reading and stories have been in my life forever. But what really made stories into my passion was the day my godmother gave me a book. This one, much loved. Grimm's Fairy Tales. I was 9 years old, and I never read the gritty, grisly versions of the fairy tales. I fell in love. I started reading myths, legends, fairy stories. In high school, I was introduced to Native American mythos and the archetypes, my favorite being the trickster. Trickster stories can be anything from learning stories to world-building stories. The animals used to represent these kinds of characters are all smart and wily. In college, I studied philosophy and religion, and I began to truly understand the fairy tales I love so much. Learning history rounded out my understanding. I know a lot of stories are under attack because of social changes. What we as a society have to remember, though, is that a lot of these same stories were also talking about social changes from the past. Stories help us relate to each other, help teach us what is expected of us by society, and teach us about other cultures. When I found out I was pregnant with my oldest, the first thing I started to do was read aloud. I was reading Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy for the first time.
I would like to read you a story from So Long and Thanks for All the Fish. It is a story being told by Arthur to his girlfriend, Fenchurch. "I'll tell you a story," said Arthur. "Good." They found a patch of grass that was relatively free of couples actually lying on top of each other, and sat and watched the stunning ducks and the low sunlight rippling on the water which ran beneath the stunning ducks. A story," said Fenchurch, cuddling his arm to her, "which will tell you something of the sort of things that happened to me. It's absolutely true." "A true story?" "You know, sometimes people tell you stories that are supposed to be something that happened to their wife's cousin's best friend, but actually probably got made up somewhere along the line. Well, it's like one of those stories, except that it actually happened. And I know it actually happened, because the person it actually happened to was me." "Like the raffle ticket," Arthur laughed. "Yes, I had a train to catch. I arrived at the station." "Did I ever tell you," interrupted Fenchurch, "what happened to my parents in a station?" "Yes," said Arthur, "you did." "Just checking." Arthur glanced at his watch. "I suppose we could think of getting back," he said. "Tell me the story," said Fenchurch firmly. "You arrived at the station." "I was about 20 minutes early. I'd got the time of the train wrong. I suppose it is at least equally possible," he added after a moment's reflection, "the British Rail had got the time of the train wrong. Hadn't occurred to me before." "Get on with it," Fenchurch laughed. "So I bought a newspaper to do the crossword and went to the buffet to get a cup of coffee." "You do the crossword?" "Yes." "Which one?" "The Guardian, usually." "I think it tries to be too cute. I prefer the Times." "Did you solve it?" "What?" "The crossword in The Guardian." "I haven't had a chance to look at it yet," said Arthur. "I'm still trying to buy the coffee." "All right then, buy the coffee." "I'm buying it." "I am also," said Arthur, "buying some biscuits." "What sort?" "Rich tea." "Good choice." "I like them." "Laden with all these new possessions, I go and sit at a table. And don't ask me what the table was like, because this was some time ago and I can't remember. It was probably round." "All right. So let me give you the layout. Me sitting at the table, on my left the newspaper, on my right the cup of coffee, in the middle of the table the packet of biscuits. I see it perfectly." "What you don't see," said Arthur, "because I haven't mentioned him yet, is the guy sitting at the table already. He's sitting there opposite me. What's he like?" "Perfectly ordinary, briefcase, business suit. He didn't look," said Arthur, "as if he were about to do anything weird." "I know the type. What did he do?" "He did this. He leaned across the table, picked up the packet of biscuits, tore it open, took one out, and..."
"What?"
"Ate it." "What?" "He ate it." Fenchurch looked at him in astonishment. "What on earth did you do?" "Well, in the circumstances, I did what any red-blooded Englishman would do. I was compelled," said Arthur, "to ignore it." "What? Why?" "Well, it's not the sort of thing you're trained for, is it? I searched my soul and discovered that there was nothing anywhere in my upbringing, experience, or even primal instincts to tell me how to react to someone who has quite simply, calmly, sitting right there in front of me, stolen one of my biscuits." "Well, you could," Fenchurch thought about it. "I must say, I'm not sure what I would have done either. So what happened?" "I stared furiously at the crossword," said Arthur. "Couldn't do a single clue. Took a sip of coffee. It was too hot to drink. So there was nothing for it. I braced myself. I took a biscuit. Trying very hard not to notice," he added, "that the packet was already mysteriously open." "But you're fighting back, taking a tough line." "After my fashion, yes. I ate the biscuit. I ate it very deliberately and visibly, so that he would have no doubt as to what it was I was doing. When I eat a biscuit," said Arthur, "it stays eaten." So what did he do? Took another one. Honestly, insisted Arthur, this is exactly what happened. He took another biscuit. He ate it, clear as daylight, certain as we are sitting on the ground. Fenchurch stirred uncomfortably. And the problem was, said Arthur, that having not said anything the first time, it was somehow even more difficult to broach the subject the second time around. What do you say? Excuse me? I couldn't help noticing, or doesn't work. No, I ignored it with anything even more vigor than previously. My man. Stared at the crossword again, still couldn't budge a bit of it, so showing some of the spirit that Henry V did on St. Crispin's Day. What? I went into the breach again. I took, said Arthur, another biscuit. And for an instant, our eyes met. Like this? Well, no, well, not quite like that. But they met, just for an instant, and we both looked away. But I'm here to tell you, said Arthur, that there was a little electricity in the air. There was a little tension building up over the table at about this time. I can imagine. We went through the whole packet like this. Him, me, the whole packet? Well, it was only 8 biscuits, but it seemed like a lifetime of biscuits we were getting through at this point. Gladiators could hardly have had a tougher time. Gladiators, said Fenchurch, would have had to do it in the sun, more physically exerting. There is that. So when the empty packet was lying dead between us, the man at last got up, having done his worst, and left. I heaved a sigh of relief, of course. As it happens, my train was announced a moment or two later, so I finished my coffee, stood up, picked up the newspaper, and underneath the newspaper, yes, were my biscuits. What? Said Fenchurch. What? True. No. She gasped and tossed herself back on the grass laughing. She sat up again. You complete nitwit, she hooted. You almost completely and utterly foolish person. We still read every night. It's an important ritual. I'm also so amazed at how many connections my boys make about situations they've never personally experienced. And it's due to reading. Leo Widrich's article also says that when a child is read to, they have a clearer theory of mind than a child that isn't read to, meaning they learn to connect quicker experiences from different situations. We are all part of our children's journey to becoming strong-minded, compassionate adults. In writing this, I kept getting caught up on the God part, the spiritual aspect of my message. And in my mind, I kept going back to the Tower of Babel. God flooded the world. When humanity rebuilt, they had a distrust of God, so they began building the tower. Two important points about the tower. One, it was built of bricks, not stones, but that's a whole different sermon. And two, it was being built to reach heaven, so if God decided to flood the world again, humans would have a sanctuary. I was raised to think that the story was all about disobedience of humans because God said he'd never flood the world again. Now I see that this wasn't why God took away our common tongue and had us scatter to the winds. I must say, I'm not a biblical scholar, so my opinion is based on how the Old Testament talks about God and my own experiences and ruminations. But I believe it was God's mortification at losing our trust and letting people see too much of one small part of creation. People became distracted by the fear to the point of letting others control them. That goes back to the bricks, not stones part. And God saw the only way for human beings to regain that sense of trust was to break up their mob mentality so that they could again see the whole of creation and their places within it. But God left a window open. Stories. Stories are integral to culture. Stories have been one of the vehicles we use to continue our culture. These stories of other cultures help us to understand and love others. It puts a part of them in us. When we have common ground with others, when you see yourselves in them and them in you, then that similarity helps you to understand that they are as worthy of love and respect as you. I would like to leave you with two quotes. The first one by Brandon Sanderson. The purpose of a storyteller is not to tell you how to think, but to give you questions to think about. The second is from Plato. Come then, and let us pass a leisurely hour in storytelling, and our story shall be the education of our heroes. If you could all stand as you're willing and able for our last hymn. Love makes a bridge. Makes a bridge from heart to heart and hand to hand. Love finds a way when laws are blind and freedom bound. Love breaks the walls of language, gender, class, good, need. Love gives us wings to sing. I would like to thank Dee, as my worship associate, my husband for reading the Jabberwocky, Phil Embry for reading Peanut Butter Sandwich, and my oldest son, Rowan, for being our pianist today.